Okay, so my name is Tim Denning. I'm a lecturer in Enniola Galway, kind of the west coast of Ireland. And what I'm talking to you about today is some parasite work that I originally started with lots and lots of colleagues at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute about 5 years ago. So this is quite a big project, and it's kind of akin to progress that have been made on malaria, except that we're many, many years behind. So a lot of what we know about the parasite is very much at the outset or of a bigger project to understand its genetic epidemiology. So there are many things that kind of that are questions that have been raised by the research that we've done. So our main focus is on this single cell parasite called Leishmania, shown in its vector stage here. It's a single cell, has a flagella in the vector stage, but doesn't in the host stage. It causes this disease, leishmaniasis, which includes a whole spectrum of different ones. We're mainly focused on the bristle form because that's that can be fatal and is much more acute than the other diseases. We're focused on one particular region of the Indian subcontinent, because that particular region is a single focus where we see relative homogeneity in terms of the genotype, but then the phenotypes we see a whole spectrum. And what we're interested in is, you know, how adaptive is its genome structure. So this particular parasite, its genome is very interesting, mainly because it can cope with very, very extensive changes in scale and chromosome copy number and all these things. So it's quite peculiar. And I guess what my main focus today is to understand how, just like a river, genes flow over time, how they might be observed together in particular populations or might diverge, and how they contribute to drug resistance. So first, let me over. Acknowledge the main, so there's lots of people have been involved in this work. It's part of a European-funded FP7 project called Caladrug. Lots and lots of people involved. I don't know them all. So what I want to acknowledge is in the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, firstly, is James Cotton and Matt Berryman, which who have led much of the work on the genetics of the parasite. Hideo Momura at the Institute of Tropical Medicine in Antwerp has led a lot of the bioinformatics and genomics work of this. And then also Jean-Claude Dujardin at the ITM in Antwerp has led a lot of the epidemiology and relating the different projects together. But I'd also like to acknowledge that a lot of other people have contributed to various aspects of the work I'm going to outline, and there's not enough time to acknowledge them all. So what I'm going to talk about today is firstly the epidemiology and history of the infection in this particular region of the Indian subcontinent, just to give you a context on how the disease emerged. I'm going to briefly touch on important aspects of its reproduction and biology, so they understand how the parasite operates. I'll also briefly outline what we know about the genetics already before going on to the main part of the work, where I'll outline the population structure in the Indian subcontinent, and I'll focus on this issue of how do we distinguish hybrid parasites from ones that are just rare or undersampled, or can we actually determine that at all? I'll also talk about drug tolerance and the challenges that we face there and how that relates to chromosome copy number variants, certain plasmid-like molecules, and also SNPs and what we need to do to address this more thoroughly. And then also I'll talk about drug induction experiment that we did with a few different parasites that has kind of illustrates the complexity of the challenge that we're facing. So what I'm going to talk about now is just some basic aspects of the parasite. So this is just a stained microscope photograph of the parasite. You can see there it's just got a single cell. It's known as a promastigote in the vector and an amastigote in the host. The host is typically human, but not always. It's important to distinguish between these two phases because in the host and vector, you have great, great differences in terms of the behavior of the parasite. It's transmissibility in the host is important. Its infectivity and mobility differs between the two stages, and it, in the two environments, there's very different temperatures and pHs. So that's important to be aware that there are many other selective pressures and not just drugs. Its vector is the phlebotomine female sandfly. One I'm talking about here is mainly transmitted by this species, but there's actually lots and lots of vector species, and their distribution does affect the incidence of infected patients. One of the parasite I'm talking about today is known as Leishmania donovani. It's mainly anthropognathic, that the infected people transmit it via the vector to other infected people. But it's important to be aware that other Leishmania species can be zoonotic, that livestock, dogs and rodents all can contribute to the infection rates too. And we're focused on this particular one, Leishmania donovani, because it infects people's internal organs, really causes really acute disease. So that typically to identify the parasites, we'll stain them and look at them under the microscope from people's enlarged spleen, samples from their enlarged spleen or their bone marrow, so the parasite can spread to all parts of the body. The global problem is, you're talking about 12 million infections at any one period of time. Many people are at risk, and there's different forms of the disease. So in South America, there's a kind of mucocutaneous form which affects the nasopharynx area. There's also the cutaneous form, cutaneous leishmaniasis, which is less severe. It causes superficial skin lesions, which are nasty enough, but it's not fatal. We're mainly focused on the visceral form, which is rarer than the cutaneous form, but can cause death. So for the visceral form, we have maybe 200 to 400,000 cases each year, and maybe a million or so for the cutaneous form. It affects many different countries, but most of these are quite rare. So it's focused on just three main regions. Firstly, the one I'm talking about today, which is India, Nepal, Bangladesh, that sort of area. And there's another one in kind of the Sudan, Ethiopia, South Sudan area, as well, and then also in Brazil, there's a focus there as well. So the Brazilian one is caused by quite different species set than these other two. So I'm just really focusing on one here today. So we're assuming that the characteristics of this particular focus should apply to other foci. What's important to note is that most people are asymptomatic. They have no they may be infected, but they don't show the disease. They're the main reason that it is spread, as the vector bites somebody who is asymptomatic, and even if they have very low parasitemia levels, it can still contribute to infection later in other people. So what I'm going to talk about now is just the distribution of Leishmania epidemiology in Bangladesh, and that's important to understand. If we want to study the origin and evolution of the parasite, it's important to think about where did it begin. So the first historical accounts of leishmaniasis actually date to 1824 in the Jessore district of Bangladesh, which is kind of down here. There were historically, we don't know if all major all events were necessarily recorded, but certainly in the years following, there was a major epidemic in Bangladesh. And since there's been several other epidemics in the Bengal region, so including Bangladesh and the Bihar region of India, I'm going to discuss more. To give an idea of the scale of the issue, back in the 1930s, a million people died in a 13-year period in that back then. Whereas after the antimalarial DDT spraying campaigns of the 1960s, in a second 13-year period, there was just 59 cases. So the antimalarial spraying campaigns in the 1960s were very, very effective at reducing infection rates, but the problem has returned. And they quite logically thought in the 1970s, VL is gone. But that's not the case. So between this period from 1994 to 2004, then there were 70,000 more cases, it's estimated. And the distribution of cases appears on certain images to be quite patchy, but that just reflects the population spread. And if you look at the rates of infection across Bangladesh and India and Nepal per head of population, then it's kind of roughly equally proportioned out. So that's why we see high rates of infection in certain areas, because everyone lives there. So we took some of the samples I'm talking about today come from this district of Manmansing, which is the main hub of people and also infections. To give you an idea of this current scale of infection, we, in 2007, only about 5,000 cases were actually reported, but it's estimated that the actual number of cases in that year in Bangladesh was 137,000, because most people don't report it. If people get sick with leishmaniasis, it's usually a process of elimination that they don't have flu or another type of fever, they just have something else, and they might actually twig that it's actually this disease. So underreporting is a major issue. Its rates of number of people infected in the population at any one time are estimated to be maybe 2% or higher. It's hard to get a really good estimate, but that's what we have to work with. And in terms of the drugs, miltefosine is a lipid-based oral drug which has been used in this area since 2008. It's also true for India and Nepal, but the problem is that sodium stibogluconate is also still widely used, which was historically used extensively all around the Bengal region. The problem is that it doesn't work very well, and a lot of the parasites are resistant to this drug. This is a lipid-based drug, whereas SSG is a heavy metal type drug. It's actually used for chemotherapy as well. So it's quite a nasty drug, and it's chemically quite different. Just like the second line drug, which is amphotericin B, which again has a different mechanism of action as far as we're aware.
Question. So I don't know, maybe it's not the focus today, but are you going to talk about a reservoir host?
No, I'm not going to talk about it today, because this is an anthropognotic disease, but certainly, yeah, that's a major issue. Canine leishmaniasis is everywhere. That's the major issue. So in Europe in particular, and the US, most cases that are observed of leishmaniasis will be in dogs, not humans. I'll talk about the species briefly later.
Okay, I'm just curious about the ecology. So what you're saying is that you're going to be talking about strains that are circulating. What is that word again? Anthropognotic.
Anthropognotic. So it's transmitted, the secondary host is, the second line, the indirect host is another human.
Okay. This is only sand fly human circulating.
Yeah, exactly. So India is the main hub of leishmaniasis, it's by sheer density of people. So in Bihar is the main focus of where it exists, which is this region here. So Nepal is here, Bangladesh is down here. So it's kind of distributed across one small area. There are instances of it being elsewhere, but they're pretty rare. Historically, leishmaniasis might have been spread more widely in this area. So it's certainly been discovered in the Garhwal Hills, which is kind of over here, above Bangladesh, but it's not really observed there frequently anymore. There's evidence of it being historically present in Bihar, but then the antimalarial spraying campaigns appear to have eliminated it, so for 2 years in the 1960s there was no reports at all, but then it resurged. So in 1977 there was 100,000 cases and many more the following year, so it appears that the spraying campaigns eliminated caused what I'm going to talk about later is the genetic signature of these spraying campaigns on these parasites. And just like in all regions, underestimation of the number of cases is a major issue. Just to give you a sense of the scale of the problem, it's estimated that on the basis of 45,000 reported cases, that there's about 271,000 cases, at least in one single year. And just like Nepal, miltefosine is the second line drug, but sodium stibrogluconate is still really widely used.
Did you say why some of these cases are asymptomatic and why some are symptomatic? Is it through immunology or
such genetics? Essentially, as long as you're healthy, you won't have acute parasitemia. That appears to be the major thing. There's a lot of potential host impact on people who we know that are infected and have the disease or have a relapsed form of the disease as well. But it's a complex thing because a lot of people that have are immunocompromised already will have secondary infections like pneumonia, TB, HIV. So leishmaniasis appears to weaken the host often, and that allows them to be infected by other things that actually kill them.
But it seems to be sort of an immune system status kind of.
The balance of Th1 and Th2 responses and the onset or the expression of particular interleukins are strongly associated with the disease.
Sure.
So the host inflammatory response appears to moderate a lot of the onset, but then it's only true in a very small proportion of cases. So
it's a bit of a
there's huge literature out there on it. It's actually other people in the Caladoc consortium have studied that in more detail.
Make sure I'm understanding this. What you're saying is that as they're infected by these other pathogens, they might be on their way to dying from them. Is that when it's detected that they have visceral leishmaniasis?
I don't know. I don't know if you can get one and then the other. I don't know the other organ of infection. They just tend to co-occur.
They tend to co-occur.
Yeah.
But you can't define leishmaniasis as like a polymicrobial disease.
I don't know. That's not my area. Maybe Richard might be able to answer that later. BHAR is interesting because antimonial resistance is estimated to be around 60%. So 60% of all parasite infections will be resistant to that drug. But it's still widely used, even though miltefosine is the first-line drug. Richard Maud last week outlined all sorts of complex things like fake drugs and accessibility, cost, all these things have major impacts, and that's why it still can be quite used. And it's estimated to be used about half the time, and therefore if you use antimonials against a resistant infection, at least 40% of people will require a second course. Another feature of leishmania is that it has the number of cases per year, which is shown on this axis, is quite variable. So it's both endemic and epidemic, that you get very, very high rates of infection certain years and low rates of infection in subsequent years.
Does this have a link to things like levels of rainfall, proliferation of vector, those kind of aspects?
Yes, but I don't know if that's been quantified.
Do you know if this correlates with malaria transfer any?
That could be the case. One of the major issues with leishmania is often there's no answer to the questions because it hasn't been studied. The epidemiology, it's well established, but I don't know if anyone has actually modelled what's going on here. Even within each year, it's quite a function of probably rainfall and the local climate.
How well do we know that it's localized in these three courses? Is it because of the vector?
So the vector is a major impact, especially I know there's been nice studies of in South Sudan and Ethiopia that certain vectors have particular forms of the parasites, and the ranges in which the vectors overlap allow hybrids to be detected in those particular areas. And so the vector is a major consequence. In terms of the VSO1, I'm not sure of the impact.
Well, if animal leishmaniasis is widespread, what is causing the transmission in animals? Still sandflies.
Yeah, it's still sandflies.
But the strains are different.
There's no genetic distinction between the infected parasites in dogs and humans, at least in the ones we've sampled. They appear to be the same, so it appears to go from human to dog and maybe back from dog to human. But I don't think, so I think there's a consortium, there's some people looking at developing vaccines for dogs, but I don't think it's been studied at a genetic level in great detail. So Nepal, we have the same situation that the malaria eradication campaigns nearly got rid of it, but not quite. It resurged again after 1980 and it spread by the 1977 Bihar outbreak into Nepal. Underreporting is a major issue. What's worrying is that the number of detected people infected in the population at any one time appears to have increased over time. And although the number of cases hasn't necessarily increased over time, the number of districts in which it's been found has increased from 16 to 26. So it's becoming more abundant. But it's focused on one particular area down here, the lowland, the Terai region of Nepal, which is quite different to the northern part, which is very hilly and mountainous. So this is basically conjoined onto Bihar. So it's all one continuous area from our perspective. And you have the same essential issues that normally mosaficin is the first line drug, but SSG is used quite commonly. Amphotericin B is the second line drug and appears to be very effective at alleviating infection. But there's all sorts of complex issues. So there's a nice paper at Mondal where one quarter of people that are infected with leishmaniasis will go to an indigenous healer and not to a doctor or health clinic or whatever. So the epidemiology of this parasite is make you tear your hair out because if people do this, then how are you going to eliminate it? So I'll move on to briefly outlining aspects of the reproduction and its life cycle. So we know that it infects humans, and in this stage it's known as the amastigo form and has no flagella and infects white blood cells. It can also infect dogs and rodents and anything that we come in contact with, livestock, cows, it'll be detected there. In this stage it's mainly, it divides mitotically, whereas in the vector stage it appears to divide meiotically. So I guess, as I mentioned before, the major difference is that there's significant selection on the parasite at these two different stages. So they're quite two different environments. So just to give an idea of the parasite, it actually has, of the complexity of the life cycle, it actually has quite a few different roles. So when the fly takes it up, it takes up amastigos from the human host, and these will convert into promastigo forms, which are quite different. And even within the promastigo, there's several different life cycle stages. So it will actually progress through the gut of the parasite and actually collect just at the proboscis of the sandfly. And there it will convert into a metacyclic form, which is more mobile and more infective. So there's quite a complex series of molecular changes that are going on. In the host, it'll try to invade macrophage cells, and the macrophage cells will try to envelop the parasite shown here in a kind of parasitous vacuole to destroy it, but the parasite will grow and divide inside the vacuole until it causes the cell to lyse, and it'll repeat this. So there's we're not talking about any extensive intra-host evolution here, but that's probably quite an extensive. So you can imagine that there's very big population sizes both within the vector and within the host, which is something to bear in mind. Whereas today I'm going to talk about inter-host evolution. So in terms of the Leishmania species, so your point on the animal infection is very valid. So there's a whole spectrum, whole category. It's hard to scale how different they are. So I guess Saurischia leishmania infects lots of animal species, mainly lizards that are used in the labs, but many different types. We don't really know how many they are because there's so many species that could be infected. They're quite genetically distinct from old world leishmania, which are the main focus of today. I'm talking about old world ones. And these are different from Leishmania viania, which is mainly South America, includes Leishmania brasiliensis, and that very diverse set of species complexes. So among the old world Leishmania, the major genetically characterized species are Mexicana major, Tropica, and also the Infantum donovani. And Infantum donovani belong to the Donovani species complex, so they're kind of closely related but quite distinct. In terms of visceral leishmaniasis, it's mainly caused by Leishmania donovani. It has 36 chromosomes and about of the order of 8,300 genes. This number is not exact because sometimes it's hard to identify in which chromosome they lie because they have extensive changes in the gene family copy number. And an important aspect of their biology is that they can be aneuploidy.
From the phylogeny, did
leishmaniasis
actually emerge from the new world
and
into the old world?
Yes, that's what's suspected. So there's some, there's lots of interesting papers discussing the really ancient origins of leishmania. So the current ideas are that it actually began in South American's sloths and existed as them as a unigenic or an orofecal transmission cycle within these species before converting to a diagenic life cycle and invading human hosts at some period, but we're talking millions of years ago. That's the current ideas, but it hasn't been studied at least from a genetic perspective. So Leishmania has an extensive chromosome copy number. But the most interesting aspect of that is that we sequence 17 genetically homogenous leishmania from a single focus. They have extensive chromosome copy number changes. And if we compare these to other species, so brasiliensis and mexicana and major and so on, we see of the same scale level of chromosome copy number changes. So the chromosome copy number should be disomic, but might vary from that. It's not conserved, and changes very rapidly over time, which is kind of counter to our natural intuition. We should think that chromosome copy number changes should be energetically costly and should be unexpected, but that's not what we see here. So the diversity of aneuploidy in other species is probably quite high. We haven't got a firm grip, but it's probably just as high in these other species as they are in any this particular focus. What you see is that there are certain chromosomes that are always tetrasomic, such as 31 here. So its copy number is always 4 or higher, using this scale here. And you can see that if we take a random sample of 17 parasites from the population, the most are disomic, many are trisomic, and the correlations of trisomy and disomy are a bit all over the shop. So essentially the main point is that chromosome copy number changes appear to be short-term ways of tolerating stress, and trying to relate them to a single pressure is something we're striving to do.
Could you say a little bit more about tolerating stress? What do you mean by that?
So they appear to become aneuploidy as their default response to any drug stress. They will change their aneuploidy state. So that will moderate, we suspect, protein dosage. That's one quick way of doing it. So it appears to be almost a kind of regulatory response, even though it should be energetically costly, and theory would predict that they should be rare.
Do they revert quite quickly if you remove the stress?
Yes and no.
All right.
It depends, yeah.
Technical question, how do you call these copy number cohorts? What's your data? So let's say first one that is...
So you can look at the distribution of chromosomes. So when you map the reads to the chromosome, you can look at the median read depth for all the different chromosomes, and typically it's quite modal. So it'll fall out as being, you know, 30x, 45, and 60.
So that's the same thing that we use in cancer genomics.
Yeah.
And it's still difficult to say if something is diploid or tetraploid.
So yeah, you need
kind of shifts, and I'm just curious how you then in practice do you have some orthogonal data to call those kind of things? Because something that looks like a complete diploid could also be tetraploid if you only look at the
Yes, so you can use the read depth allele frequency. Actually, I don't have that here. I can show you that later, but there's some, yeah, you need about 20x coverage at least to estimate that. I can show you some diagrams for that. But you can look at the number of alleles for at a given site across your reads. And let's say if you've done great and you've got 50x coverage, then if you've got a tetrasomal chromosome, you'll expect that some alleles across the chromosome should be ATTT. So you've got about 12 or 13 reads out of 50 for that particular allele. So in principle, you could get, it could be all AATT, but you would hope that that would not occur. And if you see tetrasomy, you'll see trisomy, so you'll see a proportion that will have 16 or 17 that are AATT.
You have some SNPs to also do this analysis, and that's what...
Yeah, so the SNPs are the main information. If you look at the mean distribution across chromosomes, they'll actually be usually work out quite nicely. The only challenge for doing that here with these parasites is the number of SNPs is quite small.
Is there anything interesting on chromosome 31, like stress response mean or different disigonal?
It's conserved across all the Leishmania and certainly Trypanosoma brucei. It's tetrasomic there as well. Why is a good question? It tends to be fixed. One thing that we've observed. So the gene regulatory mechanisms we haven't investigated, but we did some RNA-seq on chromosome 31 for two of these Leishmania Donovani strains, and we saw that the copy number, the gene expression number of reads, at least, for that chromosome was of the same scale as the other disomic chromosomes. So the tetrasomy may not necessarily be important. We can't assume that it's important, and certainly there seems to be extensive gene regulatory mechanisms, but we did two RNA-seq libraries and haven't moved further because there are many aspects of gene regulation to look at.
Any chances there are 37 chromosomes that do look particularly similar to each other?
Not in a technical sense, no. The main issue is assigning particular genes to individual chromosomes, because sometimes there are paralogs across several different chromosomes. That's a good point to move on to another aspect. So there are 36 chromosomes in the old world Leishmania anyway. The chromosome numbers and other Leishmania differ quite extensively. And one thing that we see are these things called episomes, which are kind of like plasmids, so they can exist outside the chromosomes. So I guess they would fit your bill of being sort of like a 37th chromosome. Typically, they're flanked by short repeats or homologous regions or ribosomal insertion elements, so that these homologous repeats can recombine when adjacent to each other, so that this episomal loop can actually become excised from the chromosome and become maintained at very high copy numbers inside the cell. So we identified one known as the MAPK locus on chromosome 36, and we found that there's two highly homologous regions at either end of this episome region of about 800 base pairs, which appear to be these recombining segments. And we see some differences for between the antimonial resistant and sensitive strains, but it's a bit weird. I think the median copy number is about 24 versus 20, which is not a big difference, but it's certainly something that we've since verified as being important. So what the key genes that we think are involved are is a mitogen activated protein kinase. So that's one particular feature of Leishmania, that they can form circular and also linear episomes inside the cell and dramatically change the copy number. So in other Leishmania Donovani species complex, sometimes the copy number of this episome or it's just one, it's just the chromosomal copy only, and there's no episome present. Previous work has tried to associate or distinguish resistant and sensitive strains in relation to SSG, the antimony drug I mentioned before. And what we find is that it's actually quite tricky to do. It doesn't fall into two discrete categories, and the number of genotypes distinguishing these two phenotypes is quite limited. We have actually a better association with the phenotype of treatment failure in patients, surprisingly, because that's an additional layer of complexity, but that gives us, we have some power to distinguish that. So previous work has been able to identify, say, three SNPs that can pretty much distinguish most of the strains that cause treatment failure from those that are sensitive to SSG and come from cured patients. So later I'll discuss more about the potential for intrapopulation heterogeneity and, you know, this idea that we might have a bundle of sensitive and resistant cells inside a single patient. So this is a quick and dirty phylogenomic tree of the Leishmania Donovani complex. So this just to give this is an ongoing work being led by the Sanger Institute, but to give an idea of the diversity in the complex between any two strains represented here as nodes. So they say from this strain here to ones over here, there's about 100,000 SNPs. So what's shown here is the scale diversity in the Leishmania Donovani complex for strains from Europe, the Middle East, South America, but that's just immigrants. Turkey, different parts of Africa, Sudan, Ethiopia, and also Sri Lanka, Nepal, and India over here. So there's some correlation with geography, especially for the European ones, which are known as infantum, which appear to be quite genetically distinct from the what's traditionally known as Donovani over here in India and Nepal. What's worth noting is that we haven't studied African strains in great detail, and there's just as much diversity there too. So previous work identified some interesting Turkish hybrids that I'll talk about here. So it appears that quite distinct types of Leishmania within this complex can form viable progeny. And the main focus of my talk will be on this homogenous group of clinical parasites from India and Nepal that are very genetically homogenous. So I said here that any pair here from either end of the phylogeny have about 100,000 SNPs. Within this group, there's only about 2,400 and 191 strains. So this is very, very genetically homogenous. We also found other strains shown as the blue nodes here from the same region, but they're genetically quite distinct. So this blue bundle here are known as the Yeti strains because they come from the uplands. And we also found one other lineage, which all of these things are probably a function of the DDT spraying campaigns and the extent to which DDT could be used in up these hills. So those particular Turkish and Cypriot hybrids are interesting. You can read about it in detail in our paper in PLOS Genetics. Well, basically, we had 11 strains from a vector and one from a human host. We sequenced them. They looked funny. They're from a single focus of Cucuroba associated cutaneous leishmaniasis, so one single small part of Turkey. We saw evidence in those strains that they were, came from a cross of two divergent parents, and subsequent selfing had led to a kind of pattern of patchy heterozygosity, so you'd have, compared to our reference strain, a bundle of heterozygous SNPs, nothing. Lots of heterozygous SNPs, nothing. Lots of homozygous SNPs, and so on. This was very serendipitous because our reference strain just happened to be closely related to one of the parents. So that's how this came. This arose. So if you look, if you compare these 12 strains to our reference, you kind of see a bimodality in the divergence rates across the genome. As some parts are very like the parent, and some are not. And we used this population as a way of estimating the relative rates of sexual and asexual reproduction in the parasites. So we estimate, so previous work experimentally demonstrated a ratio of about 1 to 40,000 in terms of one sexual cell division compared to 40,000 asexual ones. And our ratio was about 1 to 76,000. So that's the sort of rates of sexual reproduction that we got from this particular example. How true that is universally is something that we don't know essentially, but that was the first estimate. So this gives us a general idea that if we have two genetically distinct parents, they mate, and we have a green chromosome and a black chromosome from each parent, that initially they'll produce some sort of recombinant genetic mixture that, if we have subsequent selfing, will become more complex as the haplotypes get shorter and become more mixed. So that when we sample the progeny chromosomes and look across the chromosomes, what we'll see is that some parts, like black here, will look like one particular parent, and some parts, like the green here, will look like the other particular parents. It will appear as homozygous SNPs, depending on your perspective. And there'll also be certain regions shown in red here that are like both parents, and they'll be bundles of heterozygous SNPs.
What's the SNP density? The SNP density?
So in this particular example, it was pretty high. It was great because there was two very, very genetically distinct parents. So it was not really, in hindsight, very, very easy to see. It was just demonstrating that it was true was the challenge for the first time, but that's a great example. So I can give you a sense of the SNP density. What's going on? So how dense were the SNPs? So you can sort of see here that if you look at these actual chromosomes of the 12 strains shown here, the bars show SNPs. And the yellow bars show clumps of heterozygous SNPs, and the black lines are clumps of homozygous SNPs, and then we get regions where there's nothing. So it's quite clear. It was just very lucky. So essentially, I want to apply similar principles that we did in that study here, but looking at genetically homogeneous parasites to see can we distinguish different ones. Oh, great. I have lots of images on here. That's fine. So that's cool. So we sampled genomes from the sampling is, I've outlined why it can be complex. So we got samples from this region of Terai and this kind of area of Bihar. So it's not a single contiguous region But we don't, at the same time, we don't see any simple correlation between the genotypes and geography. There is some differentiation between the two groups, but it's not, it's hard to get a grip with. There's no simple association with geography other than what you see here. So what I've shown here, what I'm showing here is different genetic categories or different groups that we have found with the different colors. What we find in India is that there's certain groups like the green, light blue, and navy groups here that are more common in this area. And the green one is strongly associated with SSG resistance. So that appears to be more prevalent in India. And then in the Nepal regions, we tend to see more higher frequencies of the green and blue group here. Sorry, the red and blue group here. And the red group tends to have higher rates of SSG sensitivity. So there's some differences between the groups, but essentially it's we're viewing it as one panmictic area. So we had 98 samples from Bihar, 98 from Terai, and then also 8 Bangladeshi samples. We only found 2,400 SNPs across all the different samples, most of which were singletons, and therefore our number of informative markers was pretty small. Across all these genomes, we only saw 749 different amino acid changes, so it's very few protein level changes caused by SNPs at least. And to give you an idea that if we compare this 2,400 to strains from Ethiopia, Spain, we'll get about 100,000 SNPs as outlined before. And then we discovered another lineage known as the Yeti strains, which are actually genetically quite distinct from our clonal group of 191 here. So they have about 46,000 SNPs distinguishing them. So they're genetically present in the same region but are distinct. And we've also found one other strain which was even more distinct too. So in this set of genetically homogenous 191, we found only about one SNP per 100 kb and about 88 SNPs between any pair. There are not many SNPs in the different in the genes. There's 8,300 genes, but not many are actually changed. There are a lot of the SNPs are in coding sequences, and we can infer from the relative rate of non-synonymous to synonymous change, which should be under complete neutrality about 3-1, that our rate of about 2-1 is symptomatic of a population expansion, because our ancestral rates of change are about 1-1. So we expect that there's been a recent population expansion, and that's why we have an abundance of non-synonymous change that is rare, because there hasn't been sufficient time for purifying selection to act.
Is that recent population expansion, do you think that is to do with this DDT impact, or is this more ancestral?
The population expansion is more recent.
So this is post vectors being wiped out by DDT?
It's probably post the use of antimonials.
So this is a very recent.
Yeah. But there, in terms of their generation time, it's long. Just our, it's our perception. Yeah. So, we haven't timed identifying, getting the molecular clocks and all this everything set up properly hasn't quite been complete yet. But it looks like that antimicrobial resistance was most common after 2007. So we think after 2007 that the population size increased most rapidly then.
Because as we had a large amount of resistant parasites that could then invade hosts without fear.
So the antimicrobials, I think, were used, or that their rate of usage tailed off then in 2008 to 2012. So the population expansion is kind of, we think it's bimodal. Needs further work, but certainly the reason that we would have this high abundance will be, rather than being adaptive, it's just an excess in the population. In terms of the genetic structure of these different strains, this is a neighbor joining tree of all 2,400 genome-wide SNPs, and this allows us to to categorize the parasites into the different groups. So shown here in yellow are the Bangladeshi parasites, which are form quite a distinct group, and our route for this phylogeny would lie about here. So this means that for the purposes of our sampling, that we need to perhaps sample more in Bangladesh to get an assessment of how diverse they are. There's different groups here. So this red group was very prevalent in Nepal and is associated with sensitivity. This green group is associated with SSG resistance. Then there's other strains here that are categorized here as being discrete clusters, but on the basis of our other results, but are quite heterogeneous, at least as represented here. And there's also a group of strains from Nepal and India, that some of which form discrete clusters and some of which are more mixed. So these groups are basically determined on the basis of structures, interpretation of the correlation allele frequencies across the different strains. So if we try to estimate the normal populations from going from 4 up to 9 or higher, they form into relatively discrete categories that will have our Bangladeshi strains here are different to this grey group here, are different to this red group, are different to the SSG group, are different to these kind of blue groups, the colored shades of blue, because they're kind of genetically similar. And then we've also other strains that are heterogeneous but have some signal of being similar. And then there's a whole bundle of 21 strains that seem to be quite complex, possibly rare, possibly ill-defined, but at least their member proportions according to structure can't be figured out.
This is a mixture or structure?
Structure. So, in terms of the dates, so the population, trying to estimate, get good estimates of the clock is not easy. So here, plotted here are the posterior density estimates for of the dates of the each of the different groups. You can see that the credibility intervals for each one are quite wide, and that we have differing estimates whether you use a relaxed clock or a strict clock. Especially for certain groups. So the dates shown here have quite wide intervals, and it's hard to get a very certain date. What's more interesting is that they tend to conform on similar time values. So the relative dates might be more informative because we can use historical information then to work to track back of what region is actually feasible. So if we look at the red group I showed before, that appears to emerge from the 1960s, and the same with the green group, whereas other groups appear to have older dates, which might be a function of the relative recombination rates within the different groups. Graphically, we can place these on, this is just a maximum likelihood tree of the different groups. So if you look at the green group first, this is associated with SSG resistance and appears to have rose somewhere in the early 60s. We see the same for this red group, which appears to have risen about the same time. So this appears to be kind of a symptomatic of a long duration of low genetic diversity during the DDT spraying campaigns that will be occupying maybe this region in the phylogeny. And then after, as you know, there's epidemics in 1977 and also in other years too. So that appears to be possibly associated with a kind of radiation in a phylogenetic sense. So we tried to use phylogeographic models to estimate the geographic location of origin of the different groups, and we're pretty certain that this SSG-resistant group arose in India with high confidence. And then we also highly likely that this whole set of different populations going from here all the way over to these ones here all arose in India, whereas our Bangladeshi strains shown over here may have their genetic ancestor is might lie in the Bangladesh and not Bihar. So it's difficult. Well, we have to assess the genetic and historical origins of these parasites. So it's not impossible that they might have originated in Bihar, spread in Bangladesh, spread to Bihar, and then blackened to Bangladesh. So there's a number of samples for which we see kind of quite heterogeneous picture. And then there's also other ones not shown here that are even more heterogeneous than this. They just don't fall into relatively discrete, or they're not, we can't use their genotypes to categorize them easily. One group I'll talk about later is this particular one here, where we see only two SNPs in all the different samples there. So to give you a sense of scale of the diversity in that group, we sampled, in that particular genetically homogenous one, we took 21 samples. We only found two SNPs within that group, which is quite different to the other groups that have a relatively high rate of SNPs, even though the sample sizes vary a bit. And then we also had this kind of bin of 21 strains that could not be assigned clearly to any given group. So my main, what I'm going to talk about next, is how we set about categorizing them. We have some information on drug sensitivity and resistance, but not for all the different strains in all the different groups. So that's part of a limitation of how we can interpret our results. We see a difference between these two groups here, so the red and the green one. The red one is mainly antimonial sensitive, so there's 11 versus 4 there, whereas for the green one, the relative rates appear to be higher, but that's only for a subset within each group. So if we look at the structure results, we have the question, are these 21 strains, are they just rare populations that are undersampled, or are they hybrids? And how do you go about distinguishing which they are? So this is a tricky thing for these kind of parasites, because typically, if you think about a hybridization event between two different parents, shown as green and blue here, and yellow and black, and we've sampled one chromosome, we'll get some sort of mixed picture, which I outlined for the Turkish strains before. The timing of this hybridization event will have a major effect on our power to detect it, and also the possibility that there's multiple hybridization events as well. But at least genetically, the distinction between a rare lineage and a recombinant one should be relatively clear, because of the rare lineage will have many new SNPs, and it will have few heterozygous ones, or at least nothing different from our other population, and it should have new haplotypes. But in the context here of 191, the question is raised that if they're genetically homogenous, then, you know, do we actually have power to address this at all? Can we say they're different really, or can we say much? So a nice way of playing around with this is to compare the genetic difference distance of all the strains I compared the genetic distances in terms of the number of homozygous SNPs and heterozygous SNPs for a few strains from each of the populations. So I took one strain from the Bangladeshi one at the top in yellow, grey, red, green, this dark blue one, and this light blue one as our reference populations, against which all the strains, so ignore these because they're a bit mixed, as our reference populations, just to compare what's our relative rates of homozygous and heterozygous SNPs. So if we call our number of homozygous SNPs called against any different population should be relatively static, unless they're from the same exact population. And for six interesting strains, we see a high rate of heterozygous SNPs. And if we compare the number of heterozygous SNPs in those different strains against the other ones from the major populations, we see that it doesn't change If we compare them to certain ones, that they're roughly in the same position here. But if we compare them to the genotypes in the green and blue populations, we see quite a different picture. So they don't quite follow our expected pattern, and the number of homozygous and heterozygous SNPs changes. So this gives us some impression that something is going on here, but how do we grapple with that? Okay. So to give an outline of how what said that recombination was rare, I think we can apply simple tests like the 4-GAMI test to get an estimation of how frequent recombination is in this population. But a better way to grapple with this is to use a suite of tools known as ChromoPainter and FineStructure that look at the relative number of shared haplotypes across all the different strains. So if you imagine that for individual chromosomes, even though we've only got a few SNPs on each one, we can look at the correlation between the extended blocks and rather than the correlation of the individual sites only. So if our extended blocks are very, very similar between genetically different strains, then we might have something more to say about them. So if we look, these results require that you estimate the likely number of blocks on your different chromosomes. So essentially you can exclude information associated with singleton or rare SNPs, which can give you different types of information but are not useful for this. So for our work here, we only found 610 ancestry informative SNPs out of our 2400, so those were actually the input information into this. We did find that the number, expected number of blocks is about 80 between any pair, and then we were able to identify the number of shared haplotypes between any pair in the 191 against each other. So we can kind of scale the number of shared haplotypes for this axis here, again for the same major populations, which are shown here as a matrix. And if you zoom in and look at, say, the Bangladeshi strains only, we can see that the number of shared haplotypes in that particular group, which are genetically discrete, is high, and in the other populations is quite low. So this appears to be informative for the known populations. And if we apply that same criteria to other populations like this one here, you can kind of see the number of shared haplotypes is much higher than it is for other groups. So if we do that for all 191 versus 191, we can see that the groups kind of fall out. All the red strains are similar, all the green ones are similar, same with the blue ones, although to slightly different degrees. What's interesting is then if we take our 21 unknown strains down here and look at the similarity across the population, and the same as represented down here, you can see that certain strains have some similarity to the other strains in the other populations, just purely on the basis of the number of haplotypes shared. So this gives us some estimation of certain strains in this set of 21 that are quite similar in terms of the haplotypes to the other populations and the ones that are not. So we can use this as a criteria to discriminate. And just for verification, this haplotype work recapitulates our SNP based criteria quite well, so you can basically use both of them. Actually, I think the haplotype based approach is more powerful, because if you do some simple type of analysis like PCA, you can capture more of the total variation across the genome, say like 32%, whereas if you do a SNP based approach with Smart PCA and Eigenstrat, you'll get much lower portions of the total variation. And this approach actually distinguishes the major populations, say red, blue, and green, shown here, whereas Eigenstrat might identify the genetically most distinct populations first and not the most interesting ones. So to grapple with the population structure in a way that is meaningful with these kind of unknown strains, I took representative strains from each of the main groups, so the yellow, grey, green, and blue ones. So six different representative strains to see if our 21 rare ones could be categorized into those different groups using the Chromo Painter model that can estimate, that estimates for any individual site that its ancestry being, or that its ancestry on the basis of haplotypes for an individual SNP site can be assigned to one of those six populations with a 1 in 6 chance as our neutral estimation. So if we look at that for the 21 different strains listed down here, and we try to say with some sort of probability value, what's the chance that a SNP is associated with a particular group? We can use a criteria of greater than, I think this was 40%, and a more strict criteria of more than 95%. We can see that most of these strains aren't easily categorized into the Bangladeshi ones, as you would expect. And this other group, no SNPs appear to have a high probability of belonging to this group, whereas for our some of these are genetically closely related, appear to have a high proportion of SNPs that belong to this particular red group. And we've also some interesting strains where we see a mixed pattern having high chance of some SNPs falling into the SSG resistant group and also another group. So we've kind of got two ancestry proportions or some evidence of some mixed ancestry here. So you can see actually in terms of the raw numbers that what we're looking at here is actually quite small, but I'm going to argue that this about 50 SNPs between two genetically distinct parents is actually sufficient to distinguish between just to identify an admixture event, but below that you might not get anything.
So these isolates that are coming from these strains, since are these mixed ancestries, are these geographically located where you would expect two of those distinct groups to have met, or kind of they following migration?
Yeah. So working out the exact origin, so you can see here that there's this light blue and dark blue group are kind of they're on the same genetic lineage in a rough sense.
Yeah.
But we know, so we can't distinguish necessarily that one which group contributed to these. The what I'm going to argue are hybrids. But we know that this lighter blue group is geographically in the same region of Bihar as most of these hybrid strains are. So slightly that arose there.
So it does make sense they're in the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
Hybrids are likely.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. But then identifying the exact parent is, I've tried and you'd be tearing your hair out. So we can look at patterns across different groups, but identifying exact parents, I tried assigning each of these hybrids, you know, from your set of 191, can you choose two parents that explain the genotypes that you observe? And
those are obviously contingent on you having sampled the right parent.
Yeah, which
or
we have.
The parents, you know, have existing in a state to be sampled in the population that will give you these patterns back.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I'm sorry, you have lots of slides left. Probably 10 minutes time, so if you want to.
Sure. So we can paint the genomes using the Chromo structure framework. So this is kind of what you get for the 640 SNPs. What you can see here is that we kind of get a mixed bundle for the unknown strains down here, which is just simply a reflection of the shared haplotypes. And if you look at this from a kind of a signal processing perspective, you can actually assign a good chunk of the ancestry informed SNPs to being definitely belonging to one population. So this is an example here for one particular strain. So the raw numbers of SNPs is quite low, but our confidence level for those particular SNPs tends to be quite high. So that's where we have some confidence that this approach might work. And then there's also strains for which we actually can't say anything. We just know that they're rare and we haven't sampled something that's related. So if we look, shown here is a genome-wide phylogeny of the phased haplotypes for each of these strains. partitioning out with the idea that some this set belongs to the blue genetic group, and this set belongs to the green group. So this is associated with SHG resistance. Because each of the putative hybridization events appears to be completely six hybrids and there's five independent events, the actual genetic patterns are quite complex. So what's highlighted in blue here and green are SNPs for which we have good confidence in their original ancestral populations based on the haplotype, the extended haplotype, which is not necessarily shown here. So roughly when we look at the genotypes, we can have some confidence that they're associated with the different groups, but the patterns for any pair are quite complex. And we can also apply that to other strains that are mixtures of the dark blue and light blue groups shown here. If you represent this data on a haplotype network, it is initially complex, but it makes more sense once you go through it. So you can see that for the other groups, they're genetically quite homogenous, not much going on. But if we look at the haplotypes for the given chromosome, is 35, we can actually link them to the two together, that a lot of them belong to the green group, but then the other group belongs to the blue group, but appears to be quite genetically complex because the blue group appears to have shown in here and here, but there's other strains that are closely related that have ancestry tracks from this group that are indistinguishable, and that's why we see that signature of ancestry from haplotypes derived from this group and then also from this group. It just appears that they're similar to this group because of the way that the model is trained, and therefore we see admixture between different sets of strains down here and also the SSG resistant ones up here. So you can work out actually that some of the haplotypes are quite did arise at the same period of time or in the same genetic background, and also sometimes their timescale will be the same. And if you do this with different chromosomes, you see that the overall pattern of shared haplotypes is similar, but that the events all appear to be independent, so there's different links between different ones. And this explains why our genotype pattern is not quite simple, that there was one hybridization event that gave rise to whole pile of samples. The individual pairs appear to be quite distinct. So I'll discuss briefly the genome plasticity work, which is mainly done by my colleagues. What's interesting about this is that we see a lot of these episomes appear to be quite prevalent in these parasites. So I identified a group of 191 that have two conserved episomes in all of them, and also the Yeti strains have a separate set of their own episomes. We see there are some small indels in the coding sequence, one of which is associated with drug resistance. We also see extensive copy number variants. So the MAPK episome I outlined earlier, that appears to be conserved at a much higher copy number in this particular green group than the other groups. But it's not a simple binary comparison, but certainly we know that the vast majority of these appear to be, or the high proportion of these appear to be antifolial resistant, and these tend to be sensitive, certainly in this group here. So that appears to be a dosage effect, that this exome is able to assist them with tolerating antimonials. And then also we discovered a two-base insertion that needs to give rise to a premature stop codon in an aquaporin transporter. And so this is a known transporter of antimonials. It lets the trivalent form of the drug come into the cell. So this is a known transporter for the drug, and it's So estimating, in terms of mapping the reads to the reference genome, given that there's an indel, is sometimes difficult, and estimating absolute numbers of copies is sometimes tricky, but it appears to be near fixed in all the IS-005 strains, these SSGR strains. So shown here is the lowest copy number of this particular indel mutation that we observe. So most of them are actually close to one, but sometimes we see this deviation away from one, and we don't know if that's just a technical issue or if that's real. But what we do observe then in our putative hybrids is that the copy number of this particular indel is lower. So what we appear to have, because it's kind of a continuous distribution, is kind of mixed cell population, where we actually see intermediate phenotypes in terms of their SSG resistance for these ones. So
this is just counting how many reads out of all reads have that.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
And this is a region that has 30 copies, or it's almost a continuous trend, as you say.
I think we had a median coverage of 44x across all sites. So for this region.
I mean, in terms of how many copies of this gene are there?
It should be, I think there's one copy only.
Okay, so then I don't really understand how what this means, because then you would have basically. It's like homozygous, heterozygous, or not in the sample, or this is a mixed sample.
Oh, yeah, it appears to be mixed samples. They've got a set of cells, okay. And they're different.
So this is a bulk sequencing of.
Bulk sequencing of a collection of cells. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, in theory, they're cloned. So, typically, they're isolated from the patient, and they're grown in culture, but they're then cloned and then sequenced. But that's not true for all cases. Increasingly, people are just taking the isolate and extracting DNA from the isolate, which is a collection of cells, and then sequencing that.
Yeah. Okay. It makes sense if it's a sample of cells.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the key message, that this is a collection of cells. So, we did some drug induction work, where we're able to identify. Different markers associated with metaphyseine drug resistance. So I just want to finish on that point. So if we put the parasites in different doses of metaphyseine in a stepwise manner over a whole, this takes about 6 months to do, what we see first at about 3 to 6 micromolar of metaphyseine, which is a lipid-based drug, is that the copy number of one particular chromosome 13 will fall from 3, which is its natural trisomic state, to 2 first. So that appears to be a kind of a default stress response. It'll downregulate that chromosome. We suspect that's because on this chromosome there's a particular gene known as the metaphyseine transporter gene. So if it downregulates that, there's less of this transporter and therefore less of the metaphyseine inside the cell. So metaphyseine gets inside the cell through this transporter, but also possibly through the membrane itself as well. So in this particular antimicrobial sensitive parasite, what we see is that at 3 micromolar of metaphyseine, we see this mutation shown in brown here, which is a particular deletion of this metaphyseine transporter gene, about 9 kilobase deletion. And that the frequency of that deletion increases over the time of the experiment. But what we also see, which is the most surprising aspect, because this is a cloned set of parasites at the start of the experiment, is that a different resistance mutation occurs. So this is, I have lots of evidence of why this is a mutation that prevents the actual gene being expressed properly. It's not even just a truncated protein, it appears to completely stop transcription of the gene. And this particular mutation occurs as well. Probably we have some evidence that a few reads at 6 micromolar and many more at 12 micromolar, and that increases in frequency too. So we have two resistance mutations for the same phenotype, the same outcome. You inactivate the gene, parasite's happy. But that kind of gives you a sense of how many, how much cellular heterogeneity can exist, at least in terms of drug resistance, even though it's the same genotype and they've only got a handful of heterozygous SNPs, you can still have two completely different mechanisms occurring. And if you actually look in the literature of all the different miltefosine transporter mutations, they all appear to be non-synonymous ones that occur, like our KELCH one, that's focused on one domain. Here, any part of the gene appears to be enough. There's no pattern. The only consistent thing is that on the basis of the deletion, it appears to be that if you have no protein, you can't bring miltefosine inside the cell. So that's kind of an idea of this issue, that at low doses of miltefosine, to which the parasites are commonly resistant to anyway, like 3 micromolar, we'll see a chromosomal downregulation, so you get an aneuploidy tolerance. And then above, here we've identified 12 micromolar as the key point. Above that, you require a second change, which could be a SNP structural variant indel episome, and this is associated with resistance, but the mechanisms of resistance appear to be very, very many. So that's my main endpoint to the talk. We've got an understanding problem. We can produce hybrids, so you can get interspecies hybrids of Leishmanian major and Donovani, which are genetically as different as the human and the mouse. So hybridization operates over every scale. There's lots of mechanisms of drug tolerance, and that's our major confounding issue with this work that's going on. So our main focus next are to look at, you know, what's the unit of evolution? Is it the gene or the chromosome? Can we identify, say, mutations on the trunk of the phylogenies that are associated with resistance? And then a few other ideas of how we can look at this. So, do you have any questions?
Thank you. Michael?
I mean, you showed this nice phylogeny where you had these geographical splitting. There was this India, and then showed the timing. Now, there was in part of them, it looked like part of this was a bit like a trunk, but it wasn't. It wasn't completely obvious.
Yeah.
So I wonder, from what you've learned, how we one can relate tree shape to selection. Is there something? Is there a signal of?
Yeah. That's quite possible. So you're talking about this.
This thing, the red one, has a little bit of a structure like this, but it's not super clear cut. So I wonder.
Yeah. It depends.
If one just looks at, for example, you know, coalescence times on these trees or so, is there a signal? I mean, they look very non-neutral. I mean, they look very differently non-neutral, but the brownish one has these long legs. And
these ones are missing. So the confection rates dictate what patterns you might see here. So here it appears to be no mixing going on at all. Here appears to be mixing within this particular group. That is true that we get a nice kind of trunk-like phylogeny there, but then that's disturbed in other situations in the phylogeny. So I'm not sure. It's hard to know whether it's a function of our sampling that we just haven't sampled broadly enough, or if these things are general patterns that are going on. It appears to be really stochastic that we can get a situation like this where you get this kind of radiation of 21 strains, and this was sampled over 2 years. So it's not like they sampled one, you know, extended family. This is 2 years of samples. What's most interesting about this is that if you look at the correlation of haplotypes or SNPs with time, there's no link. So it appears that we can assess that there's some plaque-like mutation for these trees, but If you look at the correlation of genotypes and haplotypes with time, there's no clear link. So the relative length of any one of these branches doesn't necessarily give you very strong information on its rate of adaptation.
Do you have a follow-up for this one?
For this one. So does this analysis include singleton SNPs in it as well?
Yeah, all.
And if so, you know, are they evenly distributed across this or very much clustered towards that ISC009?
A lot of these genotypes actually are co-occurring on this particular branch. So the problem is that for SNPs arising by mutation, they represent in a tree is accurate and straightforward.
Yeah, yeah.
But this, you know, you've got a whole pile of different phylogenetic signals across the different sites, so that's why they appear as a bundle.
Not at all driven by singles and SNPs, though.
Like, if you look across the genome, look, this is kind of a nice tertification almost here. So this particular shape will be sorted by two-thirds of sites, but then there's actually one-sixth of sites that, in two cases, support quite different arrangements of these particular four groups.
Do you suppose your long lines on some of these is because presumably the actual phylogeny or your kind of phylogenomics is going to be highly reticulated?
Yes.
So by forcing a non-reticulated phylogeny, really are your long threads just simply because there's a high degree of reticulation and so it just forces it into a long lineage? And so in essence, it's really an artifact of the analysis rather than a property of the critter?
That is true. So you have drawing a network, you get extensive reticulation if these are present, but if these are absent, you see much less, or you only see it within these particular groups. So these are discrete clusters. So that's why we can differentiate between these six groups here and the rest, which are a bit more mixed. And certainly a network would be a better way to represent these in many ways, but people retreat more easily. That's why they're here. But the length of the branches, certainly for these groups here, are an accurate reflection of their genetic distance. Yeah.
So if you go back to your last slide with the resistance mutation,
yeah.
So you didn't tell us much about the experimental design. And do you have replicates? Sounded that it was a long effort to. What's the assay that you have for this parasite? This one, yeah.
So a number of replicates. So we did for the gene. I did this to two different biological samples. One of which was antimicrobial sensitive, one of which was antimicrobial resistant. In terms of the number of genome sequencing technical replicates, we only have them maybe for the final stage. Through the initial stage in about 4 to 6 libraries in each case. But then the intermediate stages, we only have one single sequencing set. There's some limitations between each stage because of the culturing limitations. They have to be passaged. So every week their census population would go from 10 to the 6th. They'd be going up to 5 by 10 to the 7, and then it would fall again.
Yeah. So how many, let's say you have these two populations, initial populations, sensitive and resistant, how many replicas of each you propagate in this?
Just one of each.
One of each.
Yeah. But we do see some consistent change. So shown here are the changes associated with the resistant and the sensitive. And we see there's quite a lot of changes that are just spurious or specific to individual strains. But we see certainly that the chromosome 13, as I mentioned before, is downregulated. We see the sensitive and resistant ones both alter the metaphysine transporter gene, but in different ways. So deletion or non-small SNPs. And then also we have other changes, but these are the key ones.
So this 74 plus serotype point, is it that you've tested the final isolates?
Yeah, and passage them without metaphysine for 2 weeks more.
One of them is a huge deletion, right? There's 9 KB deletion.
9 KB deletion,
and
yeah.
The other one is just a single point deletion.
Yeah.
So, have you, I mean, I'm guessing it's probably difficult to introduce it back into the ancestral and then check exactly what's the defect that you have when you use this transporter, right? But it seems to, I mean, have you compared those to the wild type? In a consistent way?
No, we haven't. So there's limitations. We need to culture them without the drug much longer, or do what you're suggesting to get a more accurate estimate of fitness costs. We don't see any change within 2 weeks, but that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be more longer changes. I mean, I think that this result is not worth highlighting because 2 weeks might be insufficient time, essentially.
I'm just going to ask about the protein in which the mutation happens. Is much known about it other than it interacts with multiplexing? I mean, is there a structure for it instead?
There's no. So there's. There's some structural information known about it. So it's a kind of transmembrane protein.
Okay.
I think there's 7 transmembrane domains or thereabouts.
Okay. GPCR?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a GPCR domain or?
Not as far as I'm aware. I have more details for you later. I looked at where these mutations occur in protein, including all previous work, and there's no pattern. So if you look at transmembrane, extracellular, intracellular, hydrophobic, or not, and they occur in any section of the gene.
Okay, so let's continue discussing offline. Thank you very much.